picture of the guy. So I had a different picture in here. I got a better picture, and I forgot to switch left and right because the other guy had a different side of the room. So that's his bad eye right now. And it's proptotic. He has diffuse subconjunctival hemorrhage. His pupil is reactive still, but not as brisk as you would like. Yeah, this is a retrobulbar hematoma or hemorrhage. This is a true ocular emergency. And what happens is it's a traumatic injury to the orbital artery, causes an abrupt rise in intraocular and intraorbital pressure. The globe gets displaced anteriorly. As the blood goes through the different tissue planes and dissects into the capsule, then that increased pressure is transmitted to the globe, and that increased pressure can cause limited ocular motility and movement, but also can cause ischemia of the optic nerve. That's why you can get eye damage and blindness from it. It's pretty bad. We had a case, well, somebody was trying to transfer me a case of this the other day, and then I realized that they wanted to call Bill's Eye Hospital and not me. So here are the three major symptoms you're going to look for: pain, decreased vision, and a history of trauma to the globe or periorbital region. The major signs are proptosis, so you know, big asymmetric bulging eye, diffuse subconjunctival hemorrhage, and oftentimes the entire, you know, white of the eye is, the entire sclera is involved. Eyelid periorbital ecchymosis, increased intraocular pressure, very tense orbit, decreased extraocular mobility because of all the pressure from the blood behind there, the muscles don't move, decreased visual acuity, and they can't or cannot have an afferent pupil defect. And if you get to an afferent pupil defect, you probably lost the battle. Stat ortho consult, you know, do all your workup, eye exam, IOP, try to, well, you're not going to do a retinal exam necessarily, but if you would, you would look for central retinal artery pulsations on a fundoscopic exam, because those get lost as the pressure increases. So as the pressure in the orbit rises above the central retinal artery pressure, you lose the retinal artery pulsations. And you may need to do a CAT scan of the orbit to look for the blood and to confirm the diagnosis, and ultrasound can be used by ophthalmology. The treatment, if you find intraocular pressures that are elevated or they have threatened vision or they're complaining of visual problems, you could try Diamox, like carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, topical beta blockers, mannitol, but the actual treatment is a lateral canthotomy and catholysis to increase the potential volume of the orbit. It's a very gross-sounding procedure, but 2 or 3 years ago when Dr. Costello was here, she showed us the video on how to do it. I'll just show you some pictures of how to do it, or schematics. So basically, you lidocaine and epi just to numb up the skin, the lateral aspect of the orbit, the eye itself. Take a forceps or a hemostat, clamp it, keep it on for a minute or two. When you remove the clamp, you'll see the nice striations of the clamp and the crushed tissue. Take a pair of scissors and just cut right where you clamped. And that's the lateral canthotomy part of it. And that may be enough. However, if it isn't, or you're still concerned, then you need to do a lateral or a catholysis, where you actually cut the canthal tendon, which is the inferior one of the two. You have two canthal tendons, so if you cut the inferior one, that should provide enough extra space for the, you know, the eye to expand, the globe to move outward even more, and relieve some of the pressure. This is described in the Will's Eye Manual. If you need to go somewhere to do it, you can look at the Will's Eye Manual.
Biggest
thing that
we do wrong is we don't cut enough.
I
said, don't be afraid, it's going to
get to
a really, really deep and
then
it'll bite and then
hang
out, pop out.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, do it. Don't be like queasy, don't be gentle. Like, oh, you make a little cut? Okay. No, just do it. Because this is sight saving. This will save somebody's eyesight. And I would suspect that if done incorrectly or not done at all, and there was a delay and there was loss of vision, you're going to be pretty hard to defend it in a court of law, because it's a very simple procedure that's described in the literature that can be done to save someone's sight.
Is it okay to wait until you have imaging to confirm it or anything like that, or should you just?
No. If your patient's eye looked like that guy's eye with a history of trauma and he has decreased vision or any visual complaints, just do it.
So how far is that? Is it like a centimeter you cut or half a centimeter?
You cut pretty deep, and it's about a centimeter, at least a centimeter cut out to the side.
I'll give everyone a look and see.
So, say we suspected, I mean, we do it. I guess the benefits outweigh the risks in doing this rotation. I mean, so, actually, that's one of these questions. This is something that Alpha can easily handle.
They'll repair everything as possible. You don't have to do it because, you know, one of two things. Either you can push and wheel a wheelchair really fast across the street to Will's IHOP, and they can do it. Or they can run really fast over here and do it. But if you don't have Optum in your hospital, then you're stuck doing it.
Bill, I mean, with something like this, it's almost like with the other trauma, they're going to want CTs and stuff like that. They'll usually come over and do it with us, but it doesn't need to be done right away.
Okay. Any questions? I have the video somewhere that Dr. Costello left me about all the procedures when she talked about them. So if anybody wants to borrow the video, let me know. You can use it to review it. It has a nice. She does it on a pig. The video. So a 32-year-old female with a stab wound to the eye with a knife. She complains of pain, no vision, and bleeding in her eye. So what do we think this is? Yeah, there's a pretty big scleral laceration there. So globe rupture or other penetrating ocular injury. This is where your mechanism of injury and history goes up. You have to know what they were doing. So was it a stab wound? Did somebody stab them? Did a piece of metal fly up while they were cutting the grass? You know, what actually happened? Any prior ocular surgery or ocular injury, tetanus status, and they usually present with pain, decreased vision, history that suggests something went into their eye. And the bleeding. Now, I remember a case I had when I was a resident. We had like a 2-year-old who was visiting grandma and grandpa on the farm, and she was playing with the chickens, and the chicken clucked her in the eye. And she had this very little like mark on her eyelid, which was the chicken beak. But when you lifted up her eyelid, right underneath it was a big puncture to her globe. So she had a perforated globe injury. So take these kind of injuries seriously. Chicken clucks are bad. So other signs that you may see, decreased vision, severe subconjunctival hemorrhage, limited extraocular motility, and afferent pupillary defect. If you see intraocular contents outside of the globe, that's usually pretty bad and usually a good sign that something happened. Irregular pupil shape, a presence of a hyphema, decreased intraocular pressure, but like I said, if you suspect the globe is ruptured, don't measure intraocular pressure. However, if you can't tell by your exam, and you get all the way to the point where you're going to check an intraocular pressure, that might be the only way you detected it, because they've lost intraocular contact and the pressure is low. And then a very shallow anterior chamber, which is a judgment call in my opinion. I don't know. I'd be able to say something was really shallow or not.
Can you put fluorescein in the eye?
Yeah. So they oftentimes have other signs, things like maxillofacial fractures, corneal abrasions, lens dislocations, vitreous hemorrhages, an optic neuropathy, retinal injuries. They could tear their iris, the sphincter of their iris, so they get irregular pupillary contractions, and then commotio retinae, which is something you need to see on a dilated retina, just a white spot on the retina. So here's an example. Here's the iris pulled away from its normal attachment. I don't know how well this projects, but this pupil is irregularly shaped, and oftentimes the pupil points to where the injury is, because the contacts get extruded out of that laceration. So the teardrop pupil, usually the tear part, points towards the laceration. So remember, if you see it and you think it's ruptured, stop, get the ophthalmologist right away. Cover the eye with a metal or plastic shield. This is something you don't want to put a pressure dressing on it. So if you don't have one of those metal shields or plastic shields, if we do have an EED, you can just gently tape it over it. Just take a styrofoam cup, put the styrofoam cup over their eye, and then tape the cup to their head, and it'll stay in place, and it serves as a protective thing. If you try to check visual acuity, the pupil reaction, extraocular motility, and we'll talk about Seidel's test. This is to rule out an aqueous fluid leak to tell if the globe is ruptured or not. You put a drop of anesthetic in the eye, and then paint the area that you suspect the laceration is at with the fluorescein strip, and go to the blue filter on your slit lamp, and as aqueous comes out of it and dilutes it, you'll see a nice green stream of aqueous running, of dye and aqueous fluid running away. If it's a negative test, so it looks intact, it it's not 100% sensitive because it doesn't rule out intermittent leakage.
So. They told me a trick on that is to have a bear down if you're worried about it.
Do something to increase
not trap on themselves, but just increase their
So do something to have them do something to increase their intracranial pressure and they can see. So if I stuff start shooting across, just tell them to stop. So treatment, if you have to transfer these patients, what should you do? Well, you got the emergent ophthalmology consult or ophthalmology transfer. Keep them NPO, antiemetics, so that they don't vomit and increase their intraocular pressure and cause more leakage of fluid. Elevate the head of the bed to reduce pressure, pain control. If you have the time, try to rule out other injuries and just get them transported. Because most oftentimes, they're going to need to have an enucleation. So this is a 16-year-old. Who was struck in the eye with a fist. He complains of pain and double vision.
Hey, Ralph, just quickly, did they say anything about antibiotics for ruptured globe?
Just talk to the alpha people. They probably give them intraoperatively anyway, so it's not going to not going to hurt, not going to help. So. Like most of the reasons we give antibiotics. So this is his problem. What's he have? Orbital blow-off fracture, which by definition is a fracture involving the orbital floor but spares the orbital rim, and it usually involves the posterior medial floor, the weakest part of the orbit. So, you know, you have to have the history of trauma, time course. This is a key feature. Oftentimes you'll see people come in and say, I got hit in the eye or the face, and I was okay, and then I went home and I blew my nose, and now my face is all swollen and all that. So that's a highly suspicious injury to worry about. Orbital pain, double vision, swelling, paresthesias, and hypesthesia, so funny sensations on the cheek, and they can also have associated nosebleeds. They may have enophthalmos where the eye is sunken in, or exophthalmos where it's protruding a little bit. They tend to have limited eye movement, and usually it's in the upward and lateral plane, and it could be from three reasons. One is ocular muscle entrapment, which is the word we always can think of, but it could also be due to just some nerve damage as well as a muscle contusion. They oftentimes have eyelid and orbital swelling, pain with extraocular motility. All the infraorbital paresthesias, hypesthesias, gum, upper lip numbness and tingling. You may feel a palpable step off of the bony rim to say that there was other associated fractures. Ptosis, point tenderness, and the nosebleed may be seen in your physical exam. Same kind of thing. Visual acuity, check your pupils, palpate, you know, the structure, check the globe to make sure it's intact, and then do your slit lamp exam. Look for extraocular motility and look for any restriction of movement. Assess for double vision, check for infraorbital sensation, and probably plain films are gone, and probably CT the orbital is a much better choice. Oftentimes they have associated injuries. You need to get this head scan anyway. Might as well get the head scan and scan the orbits as well. This is a sagittal view, so pretty obvious. You don't need a radiologist to read this, but here's a very nice orbital floor, and everything is there. Pretty good. And then your floor fell out and everything's fallen into the basement. So. You may miss any of the other associated fractures, like lateral wall fractures and all that other stuff, but pretty simple to diagnose the orbital blow-off fracture on this one. Treatment, and we'll talk about some of the treatment controversy. Basically, you know, nasal decongestants, they recommend antibiotics, but no studies have proven any true benefit. But they feel that if you get an infected sinus, what can happen is it'll just go right up into the eye and cause, you know, globe infection and orbital infection and all that. So they do recommend antibiotics. Try to tell the person to avoid nose blowing, keep the head of the bed elevated, pain management, and avoid aspirin and NSAIDs for 2 weeks because they are, in case they need operative repair, they're pre-op from no NSAID standpoint. Management of these is interesting because surgical repair is controversial of when it's done. A lot of the facial surgeons like to do it early, so ENT, OMFS, a lot of their literature says to do it early, get it done, get it fixed, and be out of there. A lot of the ophthalmology literature says wait 2 to 4 weeks, because sometimes all that stuff that's herniated is not really the muscle, but all the subcutaneous tissues and other stuff, and as the swelling reduces, that stuff elevates itself back up into the orbit, and you don't have to do as much of an emergency surgery, and as the orbit heals, everything is fine. So, this is one of the controversies where, depending on who you're consulting, you plan that they can plan to manage them either much more urgently or delay. But here, when you consult OMFS and ENT and they have an orbit fracture, they automatically want an OMFS consult anyway. and then sometime in the future, all two services talk and come up with a management strategy. But
my brother went to the ER. He had this. He's a smart ass, and he was drunk, and he got smacked in the face by somebody, probably deservingly.
Twins?
Yes, we're quite close. And anyway, he's a drunk 23-year-old in the ER who got an orbital blood fracture, and he couldn't move his eye. I mean, he had entrapment and nerve impingement. And he sobered up, got signed out, was sent home with follow-up instructions that said, follow up if any of these things occur, which everything that they had on there was occurring at the time, and didn't even give him a follow-up and this and that. And this is like the trauma center in Austin, which doesn't say much. The healthcare there's pretty crappy. But in the end, you know, I had to call, and he went to see a surgeon that day, and they took him to the OR that, you know, right then, and they said they should have gone probably 8 hours earlier when he was in the emergency department, because he had a numb portion to his face. So his infraorbital nerve, which is the most frequently injured, was entrapped, and so he was numb in that whole distribution in the infraorbital area. So make sure that you re-examine these people when they're sober. Because I'm sure that when he was drunk, he was just non-cooperative, and you're not going to really get a good sensory exam on somebody who's loaded. And then the guy who signed out to him, he just got some discharge instructions and left, and then called me. And, I mean, he would have lost, they said that he would have permanently lost the nerve, most likely, at least for years, and then possibly even the muscles.
Who repaired it?
A plastic surgeon and an ophthalmologist.
I do know if you read their literature, they are divided. So plastic surgeons, ENT guys, oral surgeons tend to do early repair. Ophthalmologists tend to do later repair. And have said, comparable results.
Yeah. So. He said with this one, because I called just the plastic surgeon I knew who did craniofacial stuff, and he said, you know, for him to come right in, the reason being is because of the numbness. Because he said if it's entrapped and not cut, you can release it and it'll come back. Otherwise it takes a long time or never.
And I actually had this fracture. I got in a little altercation with somebody.
And this is a true confession.
And my whole teeth went numb and part of my face. And I went to oculoplastics here, and they were fine with it. I just had serial CTs every couple weeks, and it was absolutely fine. And now I have full.
Other issues related to the head trauma.
Right.
But here's, you know, and one thing to always remember, if they actually have an orbital roof fracture associated with it, that's next to the brain, that's a neurosurgical emergency. So orbital roof, superior orbital fractures, especially if they involve the sinus, but even if they don't involve it, that's a neurosurgical consult. So there you have to throw in an extra consult, because that has a whole different level of needing repair and risk of infection. Because if you get an infection, that goes into the brain. So then you develop meningitis and encephalitis and all those kind of things, brain abscesses. So just be cautious that they have a superior roof fracture, which are rare. Dr. Christopher.
So no entrapment, no nerve involvement. Get the consult, anybody? And one step further, if you get a call back like you did last week, finger bones, they re-meet the film, we're showing movable floor fracture. You get to call the patient right away, can't get the patient just refer to the doctor for follow-up, they refer to the ENT.
My practice has always been, I call the service involved if they're on, and say, I have a patient who has X, Y, and Z, can I get them followed up? Here, for some reason, that actually, they'll actually come and see the patient. So if they don't have any nerve entrapment, nerve damage, or they can move their eyes fully, they don't necessarily need a consult in the ED. They just need quick follow-up. So I've made the call to get the quick follow-up. But here, oftentimes, they'll come down and see the patient for me, which is great. And then they can arrange other follow-up. If that case, I would just call the guy. If he didn't have any of those worrisome symptoms, I would just work on getting him either an appointment with whoever's on call for facial trauma or whoever you would use wherever you are at.
Do you call and make an appointment, or do you have them make the appointment?
Actually, if you have time, I'd have Nancy call and make the appointment, and then call the guy with the appointment.
My question doesn't have to do with emergency room treatment, but do you know how they get access to go in and fix that? How do you go in and fix it?
They actually don't do a lot of skin incision. I think it's all
infraorbital
and like up through here. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
My brother, they made an incision Yeah, like inside here went up and they put
up your mouth and they go up.
Yeah, actually, it's plastic for the floor. Yeah.
This way you don't have any scar. You're going to have some work done. And some of the complications are, like I said, a cosmetic defect, glaucoma, cellulitis, retinal detachments, other injuries. This is an actual case I think I had with Kim Lovell. Maybe. Maybe not. This is an 80-year-old SAPTA bus rider who was standing on the bus when the bus stopped suddenly, and she fell forward, and her glasses broke, and she smashed her face. And she was transported by fire rescue, and her only real complaints are pain, loss of vision in her left eye. And I apologize. Oh, you know, this looks so great on the screen. I don't know why it looks so crappy here.
Large.
Can you see it on the screen?
Yeah.
Ignore this crap. This is just some blood. But look here. Look at her iris. What's that big red? I'll tell you this right here. They can't right now. What's that big red thing in the center of her eye? What? Hypema, right. So, as you can see, these are hard things to take pictures of. I did my best with my Kodak digital camera. But it looks good. If you want to go look at it back there on the screen later, I think it looks pretty good on the screen, right?
Find that shade.
So, all right. So you guys got the diagnosis here, hypema, which by definition is red blood cells in the anterior chamber of the eye, and it's usually due to disruption of the ciliary body vessels. Some history things you want to know about. Big picture, what happened? So direct hits to the eye are most common. So I've seen it from baseballs, bungee cord snapping back. I had a state trooper who was on one of those Jeep. Anybody here own a Jeep? You know those Jeep weekends that they have where you can all, like, thousands of the Jeep people get together and do all kinds of crazy things with their Jeep and all that. For like 3 years in a row, they came to Central Virginia doing all these crazy things with their Jeep and in the mountains and all this other stuff. And he was a state trooper from Allentown, actually, who was bungee jumping or bungee something, and the bungee cord snapped back and hit him in his eye. He had a pretty impressive hyphema and all that kind of stuff. But I've also seen it spontaneously in people who are over-anticoagulated, people on aspirin, people with liver disease, bleeding diatheses, and those kind of things. And the big thing that gets spontaneous ones are sickle cell traits. So our population hasn't learned that yet, so they haven't come in with that complaint that I think I have hyphema and I need my dad.
Just so it
helps if the blood is there a little bit long enough, or depending on how much blood there is, it's sometimes a layer and it makes the diagnosis easier. They actually refer to something called an 8-ball hyphema, where there's 100% hyphema of the anterior chamber, and oftentimes a big clot, and it looks like it's black, not as red as it should be. So that's why they say it looks like an 8-ball. If there's just some free-floating red blood cells in the eye, like a couple of them, you actually need a slit lamp to see that, and they could follow through, and you're probably not going to see it. The only ones I've ever diagnosed are the big obvious ones with a lot of blood. The pupil is actually referred to as a stunned pupil. So it's a little bit sluggish, it's poorly reactive, but there is some reaction to it. And intraocular pressures can either be increased or decreased. More often than not, they're increased just because of the extra fluid, i.e. blood, in the anterior chamber. So here's a nice one from MD Challenger. I think you can make the diagnosis without a slit lamp exam. You know, here's layered red blood cells in the anterior chamber. Here's that 8-ball hyphema. Unfortunately, this is after ocular surgery because they're sutured. But that's that. It looks more blackish and there's blood in the whole thing. And this is just a slit lamp exam of a hyphema where you get that whole red hue of all those red blood cells, and that's an ocular foreign body. I didn't take that picture, those were swings. So other signs and symptoms, you can get periorbital ecchymosis, lid lacerations, subconjunctival hemorrhages, corneal abrasions, iris tears, vitreous hemorrhages, ruptured globes, retinal detachments, lens injuries, iritis, you name it, they could be associated with a hyphema. Examination, visual acuity, the pupil check, slit lamp exam, check IOP, do a fundus exam if you can. And then they actually recommend the sickle prep for any African American who presents with a hyphema, as well as CBC and COAGS if there's a history to suggest bleeding diathesis. So they're on Coumadin, Plavix, or they have any other concerns, you should actually check those. Treatment is usually urgent ophthalmologic referral. they actually, this is treated much more differently now than it was probably when Dr. Christopher was a resident. In the past, all these people got admitted to the hospital, bed rest for 7 days, and the whole nine yards. Now it's more at-home diet, at-home treatment, bed rest to a degree, had a bed elevated, that kind of stuff. So if it's a traumatic hyphema. If it's a sickle cell hyphema or other bleeding hyphema, there are other aggressive measures that you can take. They require daily examination, so you have to have a compliant patient to come back and see the ophthalmologist every day. And if they're not compliant, then they'll hospitalize those kind of patients. They keep the head and bed elevated. They should be at bed rest with bathroom privileges. Atropine is used to minimize pain and discomfort. Ophthalmology will decide whether they should have prednisone eye drops or not. That's something we don't prescribe in the emergency department. Protective eye shield, and acetaminophen for pain. You want to avoid aspirin and NSAIDs because the complication of hyphema is re-bleeding, and you don't want them to re-bleed because of the platelet effects. Other treatment includes aminocarboic acid, which decreases the re-bleeding risk by inhibiting clot lysis and retraction. If you give this, they have to be in a hospital. It's a very nasty medicine to give, so it's only used if there's really good indications and ophthalmology decides that. You can use beta blocker drops to decrease elevated IOP, and then if they need to, they could actually go in and wash out the blood from the anterior chamber. Like I said, the big thing is re-bleeding, and it usually happens anywhere from 2 to 5 days after injury, and about 8 to 25% of patients will develop it within 18 to 48 hours after injury. You can get corneal staining from the blood, so it's always, it has this reddish tint to it, the cornea gets stained, and glaucoma is the other big complication. You can develop it acutely, and then it'll get better, or about 7% can go on to having chronic glaucoma. Optic atrophy can occur in up to 10% of patients just from the pressure of the red blood cells in the anterior chamber. Any questions on the eye? The ear's a little easier. Not as much to do. So this is a landmark, the external ear structure. So 18-year-old wrestler, ear pain and swelling after a match in which the side of his head was pinned against the ground. He wasn't wearing his protective gear.
Cauliflower.
We had one of these with me about a month or two ago. We had a guy in trauma one who was assaulted and hit in the side of the head and had a big cauliflower ear that we had. Was it you? Yeah. I don't remember you. So it's usually just a firm swelling of the auricle following any trauma. The big thing here is where it becomes a medical legal nightmare is if you treat these improperly, they get a deformed ear, and most parents don't like it, most patients don't like it, so they have to call their lawyer and you have to pay for their kids to be better. And the goal of any therapy is to prevent cartilage loss and reaccumulation of the hematoma by draining it, putting a compressive dressing on it, and preventing infection. So if you go to the latest edition of Roberts and Hedges, there's a whole chapter on ENT emergencies, and there's a wonderful description on how to drain these in that book. Local infiltration of 1% lidocaine, you can do an auricular block, which is described in the book, but usually you can just do the block right behind the ear just to instill a bunch of 1% lidocaine, and it works pretty well. And then you incise the skin with a 15 blade at the edge of the hematoma following the curvature of the pinna. You just peel the skin back and the pericardium off of the hematoma. You take out the clot and irrigate it. You put some antibiotic ointment over it, put the skin fold back over it, and then put them on antibiotics and put on a pressure dressing. The whole book has the whole thing on how to do a pressure dressing. I would not do the one in there that shows you how to do it with dental rules, where you suture dental rules to their ear and all this other stuff. Yes. Just a real bulky pressure dressing and conforming dressing should be fine. They get antibiotics, they get reassessed in 24 hours, and if it develops an infection, they need surgical drainage and IV antibiotics. I'm sorry, I practice in Philadelphia. High malpractice risk. I have ENT in the house 24/7. I call ENT to drain these. I'm not going to take a chance of ruining some kids' ears. So, unfortunately, I cop out and have ENT drain these. But it's a procedure you should learn how to. You could learn how to do. So, if you're going to have one, watch them do it, because you may need to do it in the community setting. But it's well explained in Roberts and Hedges. So, I had one of these with somebody not too long ago too. 30-year-old guy struck upside the head with an open hand. Probably a relative of Corey's. He complained of the pain and decreased hearing on that side, but when you look into his ear, this is what you see. And that's not his usual. So this is a perforated or ruptured TM. Usually, and these are the questions, these are your board questions, an open slap to the head because you increase the air pressure in the external auditory canal. Or lightning. So, you know, people have a lightning victim and they'll say, you know, he has loss of hearing. That's not what you're supposed to think. An explosion and blast injury. So, you know, there'll be a, you know, terroristic bomb question and somebody can't hear afterwards. They have a perforated TM. So those are the places you see it. The other place is barrel trauma. So people come back from diving. Usually there's minimal symptoms unless middle ear or inner ear injury is present. They may have some pain and bleeding, but the big thing we'll talk about is hearing loss, some tinnitus and vertigo. And like I said, the more hearing loss and vertigo that's present, the more you have to worry about middle or inner ear injury. These usually heal well regardless of treatment or what you do for them. The smaller and more central perforations do better. Lightning injuries do worse, but I don't know if that's just because there's other injuries that you got struck by lightning or just because of the mechanism and the loud force. So just in general, as a good statement, remember lightning injuries do bad. There's no benefit to early surgical repair. You try to keep the ear dry, use analgesics and ENT follow-up. Now here we go to the controversy about antibiotics for perforated TMs. If you give prophylactic antibiotics, oral ones are preferred. If there's an infection in the canal or one develops, you should use suspension drops versus solution drops because the suspension drops adhere better and don't go into the canal. And it's controversial. There's no good studies. It's very ENT dependent, very practitioner dependent, and there's no consensus position from any of the major organizations on the review. So flip a coin if you feel like doing it, do it. If you don't. Just remember to tell them to keep their ear dry. So, you know, earplugs when they shower or a cotton ball with Vaseline on it stuck into the outside of their ear to try to prevent water from getting in. Nasal trauma. You know, young woman struck in the face with a piece of wood, nose pain and bleeding. You know, always ask, was it crooked before you got hit or not? You don't want to, oh my God, look at your nose, and then they tell you, well, it's always like that. So always ask what it looked like beforehand. So this is a nasal fracture. You know, it's a clinical diagnosis. You don't need an x-ray. You know what they all look like, you know, swelling, pain, deformity. And they only really need any consultation if a cosmetic defect is present after the swelling decreases in 3 to 5 days. So I just tell these people, you're going to look ugly for about a week. It's going to swell. It's going to get black and blue. Lots of ice. And if you don't like the way it looks after a week, go to see ENT or plastic surgery, and they'll fix it in the office. It's a pretty barbaric procedure. They put some cocaine up your nose to numb the mucosa. They take this thing that has like these two fingers on it. They put it on your septum and they just yank. And your nose goes back into place. I don't tell the person how they do it, but I'm saying, if you don't like the way it looks, you should go get it fixed. There's usually no major, you know, emergency reason that ENT needs to come and see the nasal fracture. So the big key is, and this is where you're going to get into some medical legal nightmares, is if you miss this other important injury, and that's a septal hematoma, which is a collection of blood underneath the perichondrium of the nasal septum. It looks like a bluish-filled sac, and if untreated, it can form abscesses and necrose the cartilage and get that saddle nose deformity. And once again, people don't like when their nose is all deformed. So, you know, the treatment is drainage of the septal hematoma with nasal packing. So here's a good shot. So big nose. Remember, ask if he's Italian from South Philly or if this was like just before he got hit. But here's that big bluish-filled sac sitting in his right nares. So how do we drain one of these? Once again, if you go to the Robert and Hedges chapter on ENT emergencies, there's a good description of how to drain these. In case you're wondering, I actually wrote the chapter, so that's why I keep kind of going on. Buy the book and look at the chapter.
Plug it.
So, oh, can you flip back? I hit the wrong button. So just anesthetize the area with a topical agent, so some topical lidocaine or even topical cocaine, if you know you have it in your department. Make a horizontal incision in the lump, so on the mucosa of the lump, the sac. Make the incision, suction out the clot, clean out the clot, irrigate it with some saline, and then take a piece of the mucosa off. So make a little triangle. And the reason why you do that is once you put it back together, If you don't take that piece of triangle off, the edges can reapproximate and the clot can reform. So if you just make a little defect in the cut edge you cut, take a little triangle of the tissue off, it won't be able to reaccumulate.
When you say horizontal, you mean like this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, horizontal. Oh, that way, yeah, horizontal, I'm sorry. And then packet, so you can put one of those nasal tampons in place. Antibiotics are required, not so much for the toxic shock syndrome, but more for the to prevent infection of the actual area and size. And then they should be seen at least daily for a couple of days to make sure they're not getting an infection or a reinflammation. These are actually pretty easy to drain.
Aside from the septal hematomas and the non-displaced nasal bone fractures, are you CAT scanning? I mean, I assume if it's a big displaced fracture, ENT, you want them to come down. When, do you have a general rule on when you're CAT scanning facial bones of people based on their presentation? Or?
I suspect they have anything more than a nasal fracture, I'll scan.
If you think that's it, you...
If I think they just have a nasal fracture, I don't even actually, unless they absolutely want it. So, if you have a significant injury and I think you might have an orbital fracture or jaw fracture or other stuff, I'll get a CAT scan. But if you just got clocked in the nose and your nose is all funny looking, sorry. Put some ice on it and see somebody if you don't like the way it looks.
So, kind of along that line, if you are suspect, I mean, if you suspect, you know,
actually, that's a good point. I didn't realize this until the other day, but because I caught about a question about a patient that was transferred in and they had an inappropriate study. Actually, if you order facial bones here, it includes orbits, but not necessarily the mandible. You actually need to ask for the mandible separate. So I didn't really know that until just recently. So if you're going to, depending on what you're looking for, you should probably, yeah, so if you're only looking for orbital injury, you could just look at orbits. But if you do facial bones get from the top of your skull down to just above your teeth. If you need a mandible, you should add a mandible CAT scan. So just ask at the place you practice. I think it's just all protocol.
The question is, when do you get facial bones, when do you get a CAT scan?
I think facial bones are useless. Because a lot of the techs don't know how to do them properly. They're very hard to read. There's a lot of lines. A lot of times it's very hard to make any, you're inferring that there's an injury because you see fluid in the sinus or anything else. I think with the availability of CT scan, even in community hospitals where I practice, the availability of CT scan is pretty great. So, you know, you can get 3D reconstructions, you get sagittal cuts. I think probably plain films are probably gone by the wayside. And I would just go for CT scan. Now, if they only have nasal trauma and they insist on imaging, I just do nasal bone x-rays.
CAT scan, do you CAT scan the facial bones and the mandible too?
If I think they have a mandible injury, yeah. But if I don't, if all of their stuff is on the upper face, you don't need to do the mandible.
If you order plain films in the face, radiology will call back and say, order CT,
yeah.
You're wasting our time.
Yeah, even the radiologists don't like to read them and they think it's not going to show them much information.
I say mandible injury.
Just not very, you should get a Panorex, but we don't have them here, but then I would get a mandible CT.
But a Panorex is adequate if you have
a Panorex. Panorex is great if you can get a Panorex. And then if you can get a Panorex, that's really all you need. Because
yeah.
You'll find all the mandible fractures with a Panorex, but we don't have one here.
They have one in the clinic.
They're one in the clinic, but not here. So we'll talk about the tongue, and we'll finish up with that. A 4-year-old child running foul, no loss of consciousness, and her tongue on examination. So you can see that nice little cup right there. So we'll talk about treatment principles for tongue lacerations. Large central and horizontal injuries actually do quite well without any suturing. So I would not have sutured that little girl. She had a large laceration. It was in the central portion of her tongue. She'll heal up fine. They have minimal risk of infection because it's quite a bloody area, so there's a lot of blood flow to it. You should only repair the wounds if they involve the edge of the tongue or pass completely through the tongue. So the edges, I just mean along the sides of the tongue. And if it goes through and through, you should repair those. If it's a big flap-looking laceration, because those could get particle stuff trapped underneath it to get an infection, those should be repaired. Lacerations that continue to bleed excessively, so if somebody's on Coumadin and they have a tongue laceration, you may need to put a stitch in. And then lacerations that bisect the tongue. And in case you don't know what that looks like. Apparently this is something he wanted to do. There's like this whole website and people who like have their tongues bisected so they look like a lizard or a snake or something like that. If it's a traumatic injury, they'll probably want it sewn back. Some people get paid money to have it done like this. So if you see this kind of tongue laceration, so one right down the center of the tongue and you now have two tongues, you should get somebody to put that back together. Most people don't like that. This guy apparently likes
body modification.
That's gross.
So how do you repair them? And I think the thing with repairing these is the first line. Patient cooperation is critical. So who usually gets tongue lacerations?
Children.
2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, and 4-year-olds. So there you go. There's no cooperation there. So you're going to have to really come up with a plan if you need to repair these, of, you know, conscious sedation and all that kind of stuff. You could use topical lidocaine, which is probably not a bad idea, because you can actually numb it enough that they don't feel the injection. And you can use lidocaine with FB on the tongue. You could do a nerve block if you want. And here's a neat trick. You take a towel clip or a large suture and either bite the tip of the tongue once you numb the whole area with the towel clip, and you can hold it outside of the mouth so that you can actually suture it or have an assistant hold it, or take like a big Zero Silk or Proline, take a big bite through the front of the tongue and pull it out and hold it while you or somebody else sutures it. You can use 4-roll absorbable sutures to close all 3 layers if you have to. So you can take a big bite with your needle and close it up. And then antibiotics are controversial. Some people say yes, some people say no. Just whatever you want to do.
Would these be just be like loose approximation of skin, or do you need to get to the, you know, just like a regular?
It's, the closer you get it, the better. But, you know, if the kid's screaming and you just wanted to throw one quick stitch in and you're holding, just as long as you get them closer together, they should heal up pretty quick.
So when you say all 3 layers, you're saying that you can just go through and through and
do it. You can just go through, you don't have to do a layer. Yeah, you don't have to do a layer to close. You can just make one big bite and close it all up.
Would you use like Vicryl or Chromic Gut?
Whatever you have, probably Chromic Gut, because I think it dissolves a little quicker. All right. Sure.
All right, 5 minutes, and then we'll have the...
So this Texas for the tire basically...